the mad stampede of animals. O'Malley feels it too. He looks at the ground quizzically. M? Just how big is this predator? Something's wrong. When the snake wolf came, I didn't feel anything like this. The vibrations grow stronger. Thump, 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 thump. Memories of our time on the Zolotl come rushing back. A rhythmic pounding, an organized stomping, getting louder and louder, shaking the ground. O'Malley figures it out a split second before I do. Marching, he says. But it would have to be so many. Thousands. He looks at me, half in fear, half in disbelief. Springers, I say, and ice creeps across my heart. I stand, scan the jungle. I need to get higher and see what's going on. There, a big tree, the trunk massive and gnarled, wider than most. If it's wider, maybe it's also taller. I hand O'Malley the shovel. Stay here, I say. Thick vines run up the big trunk, creepers that root in the ground and cling to the bark with hundreds of thin white tendrils. The vines, still wet from the drizzle, hold my weight, let me climb high enough to grasp a branch. I move quickly but carefully, mindful that everything I touch and step on is damp and slick. Higher. I draw even with the canopy, see the tops of trees all around me. I was right. This tree is taller than most. Higher still. The leaves rattle harshly just above my head. Something yellow and small leaps from the tree. Arms spread, skin flaps catch air, and the animal is gone in an instant, banking to slide through vines and out of sight. My heart hammers. That thing startled me. Maybe I startled it. It was the same kind of animal I saw when Spingate and I were walking through the jungle. This close, though, I saw more of it. Seemed like it was holding something. Maybe a stick? I climb higher. The trunk narrows. The branches thin. I reach the top. Here, the trunk is so slim, the tree wobbles from my weight. As if the gods are real and want to help me, the wind drops off, and the last of the drizzle stops. One of the two moons escapes the clouds and turns the jungle into a maroon landscape. I look out across the trees. Oh no. The canopy blocks most of my view, but through it, I see so many springers, it looks like the entire jungle floor is moving. A line of them march shoulder to shoulder, hopping in unison. The line stretches off into the distance. I can't even see where it ends. Some carry muskets. Most carry other weapons, axes, knives, swords, and spears. Behind the first line, a second, and a third, thousands of them. My people are hopelessly outnumbered. The war machines will be our only hope of survival. Closer the marchers come. I have to move soon or I won't be able to get down without being seen. Wait. In the middle, straight out from me, behind the second line, springers hacking at trees and vines, cutting away underbrush, stretching out behind them, a maroon streak through the jungle. They are clearing an old road. Something on that road. I squint, lean forward, as if those extra few inches can make a difference. I recognize the design. The toys Barca showed me. The ones with the long straight wooden tails. The carts that smash spiders. They weren't toys at all. They were models of something real. These are too big to call carts. I think wagons is a better word for them. The tent poles without a tent frameworks brush against overhanging branches. The thin, straight tails stretch out twice the length of the wagons themselves. The wagons are big enough for several springers to ride on top, although no one is riding. Instead, there are five springers on each side, pushing the wagons over the broken, bumpy, just-cleared road. Springers are marching on our city. They are prepared to take on the spiders and win. My people will be slaughtered. I have to go back. I have to warn everyone. The way the springer lines angle away. I turn and look back, see the city of Ukmal rising out of the jungle. Oh no. There is no way O'Malley and I could make it to the gates without the springer seeing us. The only hope of escape we have is to continue along the trail as fast as we can go. The Springer Church, the cellar where Barca hid Spingate and me. Omeokan's second moon slips from behind the clouds, adding pale blue light to the jungle. It's too bright. If even one of those thousands look up here, they'll see me. I start down, dropping fast. My hands and feet slip on wet bark. I smash my knee, then my shin, but the pain doesn't slow me. I lose my footing a third time, fall into a branch that hammers my ribs. Can't stop. If I stop now, we're dead. Branches, vines, feet, hands, faster and faster. When I reach the last branch, O'Malley is kneeling, half hidden behind the wide trunk. I drop to the ground next to him, feel the rhythmic stomp, stomp, stomp of the marching army.
Em, we have to get out of here.
For once, I don't mind his whispers. I peek around the trunk. Through the dense underbrush, I can see them coming, a line of alien soldiers hopping straight for us, weaving around trees, dipping down the far side of the jungle-choked craters, only to hop out the near side. When I turn and run, O'Malley is right behind me. We stay low and sprint down the trail. Our booted feet eat up the distance, enough that I start to think we got away clean. And then, I hear the long, droning note of a horn. They've spotted us.
36. We sprint through endless jungle ruins, doing our best to keep to the trail. Overhanging vines and encroaching leaves slap at us, splashing us with beaded drizzle that soaks our hair and runs down our faces into our coveralls. A flash of lightning. Thunder follows 2 seconds later, as if the deafening noise ripped the bottom from the clouds themselves. The rain pours down again. The horn echoes through the trees. They are chasing us. I think we're a little bit faster than the Springers, but hopping and landing on both feet makes them more stable on this rough, wet ground. I've fallen once, banged my chin on a tree root. O'Malley has fallen twice. He's bleeding from a cut on his temple. Each time we hit the ground, we're up before our momentum slows. We are wet and muddy and running for our lives. I try to see where we are, but all the jungle looks the same. Are we near the church? Have we already passed it? A double burst of lightning pulses across the night sky, and in that split-second glare, I see it. The steeple. The rings with the 6 dots. I turn off the trail, sprint headlong into the underbrush. I hear O'Malley crashing in behind me. We enter the dark steeple. It's empty. O'Malley quietly shuts the double doors while I stumble to the wall, around the statues, until I find the trap door. I open it and urge O'Malley in. From outside, I hear the horn again. Then, an answering call from the other direction. So close, they must have been just ahead of us on the trail. Did they see us come in here? O'Malley rushes down the rickety stairs, stands in water up to his knees. I descend a few steps, lower the trapdoor slowly, ease it into place, then join him. Grunting and chirping outside, the Springers are close. I look out the slot made by the missing board. Thin moonlight reveals 2 long blue feet tied up with strips of cloth. The feet are so close, I could reach through and touch them. We hear the Springers talking. The floor above us creaks. There are at least 3 of them up there. If they find us, we're dead. O'Malley's cold, wet hand takes mine. His strong fingers grip me tight. He is calm, resigned to this situation. I admit I didn't expect this from him. I would have thought he'd panic or do something stupid to give us away. Instead, his steady presence gives me strength. His eyes tell me something deep and overwhelming. If he has to die, he is glad he gets to spend his final moments with me. I loved this boy before he even woke up. I was the first thing he ever saw. Will I also be the last? The floor above us creaks again, the sound of a Springer hopping from one spot to the next. Then, the creaks move closer to the trap door. The creaks stop. We wait. I peer out the slot, through the underbrush. No feet. Just rain. We stand there, still and motionless for a long time. Any simple noise, A cough, a sneeze, a heavy breath could mean our death. We listen to the rain come down. We wait. I hear the horn blare. Distant, barely audible. The hunters have moved on. When the floor creaks again, I start to shake. Short hops, each producing a creak. The creaks coming closer to the trap door. A straggler? Or is it a squad of them? Five or more, hoping to flush us out so they can shoot us dead? If it is only one or two, maybe we have a chance. I grip my shovel with both hands. O'Malley draws his knife. Maybe we will die, but we won't go easy. The trap door slowly opens. Darkness beyond, hints of motion. A springer. They have found us. If we can't see them, they can't see us. I wait, coiled and ready to strike. When the stairs creak, I will thrust the shovel point up at my enemy. I can't breathe. I don't dare breathe.
Him?
That single syllable makes me sag with relief. Barca has come for us.
37. Soaked and freezing, I climb the stairs. Barca hops back, giving me room. He is not alone. He stands with three springers, all with lush, young, purple skin like his. I instantly recognize Lafa, by both his face and the wooden splint on his leg. His face contorts in what I can only think of as an alien sneeze, and he lets out that broken glass laughter.
Him,
he says. The other two are wide-eyed, two-fingered hands fidgeting on their muskets. Are they afraid? Do I horrify them? When O'Malley climbs the stairs and stands next to me, the two guns snap up. Hammers lock, barrels point at us.
Don't move, he says quietly.
Wow, Kevin, thanks for that brilliant advice. This isn't the time for sarcasm, but does he think he's the only person on this planet with common sense?
Lafa hops between us and the guns, a fast movement that obviously causes pain in his broken leg. He yells at the new ones. That's the only word to describe the awful noise he makes. The two new ones yell back. Barca lets out a single sharp shout. The yelling stops. The two new springers lower their muskets. There is no question as to who is in charge here.
I see it, but I can barely believe it, O'Malley says. I mean, I know you told us about them, but, well, they aren't human.
I've never seen O'Malley in awe before. He stares at each springer in turn. The two new ones stare at us in equal astonishment. The rain beats down. The leaking roof creates the same quivering mud puddles I saw last time. The waist-high statues gleam wetly. Barca hops to me, reaches out slowly. I see the fingers of O'Malley's hand twitching, drifting toward the jeweled hilt of his knife. No, I say, calmly but firmly. Pull that and we're dead. O'Malley forces his hand still. Barca touches my sternum. He looks at his friends.
Him,
he says. Then Barca's finger slowly moves toward O'Malley. O'Malley stiffens, as if he's about to run back down the stairs.
Don't you move, I say, forcing a smile. Then I wonder if smiles might be horrifying to them, with all those bare teeth and our squinty eyes.
O'Malley forces a smile of his own.
What if they have diseases?
Then you and I will be sick together. Stay still.
Barca's fingertip touches O'Malley's sternum. Barca looks at me, waits.
O'Malley, I say, sounding it out. His name is O'Malley.
Barca starts to talk, stops. His frog lips wiggle as he imagines how to make the sounds.
O'Mala, he says.
I laugh at the simple mispronunciation. I say the name slower, sounding it out.
O'Malley.
Barca concentrates.
O'Mala?
O'Malley looks at me, astonished. An alien just said his name. Or at least tried to. And just like that, Barca isn't quite as alien as he was a few moments ago.
O'Mala, O'Malley says.
He laughs with delight and relief.
Good enough for me.
A word pops into my head. I reach out and touch O'Malley's sternum.
Kevin, I say.
Barca thinks on it a moment, then says,
Kevin!
O'Malley's face lights up.
That's perfect.
Kevin!
Wafa says.
Kevin!
The other two springers say in unison. I shake my head in amazement.
Of course. Your name is the one they can pronounce correctly.
Wafa pokes one of the new springers in the chest.
Todo Bach,
Wafa says. I repeat the name as carefully as I can. So does O'Malley. Wafa points to the next one. Its name is Rikis. Rikis seems pleased when O'Malley and I pronounce that name correctly. The delighted springer hops from foot to foot. The moment is surreal. We are introducing ourselves to aliens, who are probably teenagers just like us. We are laughing together. This is simple, natural. Why was there ever a need for violence, war, and death? If these springers are with Barca and not with the army, maybe they aren't soldiers. Are they too young to serve? I have no way of knowing. Whatever their role, I don't have time to worry about it. There is a war to stop. How do I communicate that to Barca? I pantomime drawing on my open palm, point to Barca's bag. He understands immediately, hands me a swatch of fabric and a stick of charcoal. I lay the fabric flat on a dry bit of floor. I point to Barca, make a single mark. I point to Lafa, make another. Then mark each for the other two springers. I look up at Barca, waiting to make sure he understands. Lafa does first.
Kayat,
he says, pointing to himself. Then he points at Barca.
Jeg.
Then at the other two springers.
Nar.
Bodek.
He's counting, O'Malley says. They're words for 1 through 4. Simple math, simple drawings. They understand. I need to tell him I saw the Springer army. I point in the general direction of Ukmal. I start making marks as fast as I can. Parallel, short, leaving enough space so I can make 10, 20, 30, 40. I point to the marks. I point to Barca's musket. I point to my head.
Bang, I say.
I slump down and play dead. The two new springers jump away, babbling to each other. Barca quickly silences them. He pulls a roll from his bag, flips it open. It's a map of Ukmal. Rough, but I can spot the river, the waterfall, the big main roads, the mostly round city wall, the mountains to the west, the lake to the north, that crescent-shaped clearing to the northeast. It's everything I could see from the top of the observatory. I wonder if that's where he was when he drew it. Barca lays the map on the floor, then chirps a command. Rikis and Todo Bach scramble to the dirt and rubble. Each of them brings back a handful of small rocks. Barca takes a rock, holds it between his finger and thumb. He moves it through the air, makes a strange noise with his mouth, like a little boy's impression of a rocket engine. He sets that rock on the map, looks at us.
The shuttle, O'Malley says. That's where the landing pad is. They know exactly where we are.
Have they known all along? I think of Aramovsky saying how the Springers could come attack us whenever they like. Barca taps my cluster of marks. Then he places 3 rocks outside the city walls, at the edge of the crescent-shaped clearing. He reaches into his bag again, pulls out 3 small wooden spiders. He sets them on the other side of the clearing. He looks at me, waits. That must be where the Springers want to fight, I say. O'Malley leans in. 3 spiders. But the Springers got Coyote's spider, didn't they? Shouldn't there only be 2? Maybe Barca doesn't know we don't have it anymore. He's not marching with that army, so maybe he's not part of it. The prince pushes the 3 rocks representing the Springer forces into the middle of the clearing. He pushes the 3 spiders out to meet them. He pulls out more wooden toys, the ones with the wheels. He sets them on the map, in the jungle behind the clearing, on the Springer side of the battle lines. Then, he starts placing rocks with the carts, dozens of rocks. He places more on the sides, and even more in the jungle behind the spiders.
A trap, I say.
They're only going to show a few of their troops, lure the spiders out into the open. They'll have our people surrounded from all sides. They'll destroy us. How long have the spiders been slaughtering springers? How long have the springers cowered underground, waiting for a chance to fight? And along we come, mastering the spiders, getting them to march to our command. Maybe this is the moment Barca's people have been waiting for. A chance to put all the spiders in one place, so they can battle it out once and for all. I don't know how they will lure Aramovsky to that clearing, but I don't think it will take much. Even if Bishop recognizes the trap, will anyone listen to him? Aramovsky has total control. He has already said he wants to march to the jungle and bring the war to the Springers. He's going to get my people slaughtered in the process. Barca makes one final drawing, a few lines, a half circle, and it's done. A ziggurat, with sun rising behind it. Daybreak, O'Malley says. They're going to spring the trap at dawn. How do we stop it? O'Malley doesn't answer. I take Barca's hand. He pulls back at first, surprised, but maybe the look on my face lets him know I mean no harm. His skin is warm, his grip strong. We have to stop this battle, I say. You are royalty, or whatever. You have to get them to stop. O'Malley's eyebrows rise. Royalty? Something like that, I say. The one we think is the leader, he has the same necklace Barca has. They are the only springers we've seen with that kind of decoration. That inexpressive, stone-faced look washes over O'Malley's face. To stop the battle, we need a unified front, he says. You ask our people for peace. Barca asks his. But Aramovsky won the vote. You were there. He's not going to listen to me. And we don't know if Barca's father, or mother, or whatever, will listen to him. O'Malley reaches down to the map, moves the spiders back to the edge, then does the same with the rocks representing the springers. The two sides are once again poised for battle. He walks to where the floor is dirt, looking for something particular. The springers hate us because of what the grown-ups did, what the spiders do, O'Malley says. He bends, picks something up. Many of our people hate the springers because of Visca's death, and Aramovsky fanning the flames. He picks up another bit I can't see. He walks back to the map. Those are key reasons, but mostly, I think the sides hate each other because we're so different, he says. Different is scary. What we need is a gesture that shows we're not so different after all. A gesture that sends a clear message. No one has to die. We can talk to each other. He has two bits in his palm, a ground-up piece of green glass, and what might have once been a small coin. O'Malley gestures at Barca with the coin. This is you. He then gestures to me with the piece of glass. And this is you. He places coin and glass next to each other, in the center of the clearing, right between the two opposing armies. The two of you, together, he says. Show both armies it's possible for us to get along. If our people want to fight, they have to go through you, Em. If Barca's people want to fight, they have to go through him. I imagine the lines of springers, with their muskets and knives and axes. O'Malley is asking me to stand in the middle of that clearing, face them down as they rush forward, eager to kill us and take their planet back. I look at Barca. He's staring at the map. I wonder if he's imagining being next to me in that clearing, staring at mechanical monsters pounding toward him, the same machines that killed his sibling, that drove people underground. Will he be brave enough to stand there? Will I? Do we even have a choice? The sun will rise in a few hours. I could go back to the shuttle, but I already tried talking my people out of war. I failed. Aramovsky is just too powerful. And I get the strong feeling that if Barca could have stopped this on his own, he already would have. O'Malley slowly reaches for his belt. I see Rikis and Totoback stiffen, but O'Malley doesn't draw the knife. He removes the entire sheath, blade still inside. He sets it in front of Barca. O'Malley raises both hands, palms up, takes a step back. Peace, he says. Peace. It is an impossibly simple association. Hands empty, a show of not having weapons.
The knife is dangerous. O'Malley could have used it to attack, but he makes a point of giving it to the being that could be his enemy, that could use it against him. O'Malley is unarmed, defenseless. Barca stares at the sheathed knife. He pulls the hatchet from his belt, the one he used to hack the long-necked monster to bits. He offers it to O'Malley, handle first. The combined gestures of trust are unmistakable. O'Malley takes the hatchet. He bows. "Thank you," he says. Barca, the springer that might be a prince, picks up O'Malley's sheathed knife and slides it into his belt. That's not what O'Malley intended, I don't think. But maybe an exchange of weapons means something to the springers. Barca picks up the piece of glass and the coin. He makes a fist around them, turns his body to face me square. There is something ritualistic about the motion, like he wants to make sure I understand how serious he is. "Peace," he says. "Him. Peace." Lafa lets out a singing sound that makes me jump. Barca and the other two springers join in. I look to O'Malley, wide-eyed. He shrugs. The singing stops. Each of the springers reaches into its bag and comes out with different kinds of food. A long vegetable that looks like a white carrot, a handful of berries in a pocket of cloth, a chunk of dried meat, and something that makes me think back to the warehouse and Farrar's poisoning. Alien culture or not, there's no mistaking the round, bumpy form of a homemade cookie. I push my hunger down, forced it to hide away, somehow. Now it rears its head, undeniable and overwhelming. The springers tear their bits of food in half, offer the halves to us. I wind up with dried meat and half a cookie. O'Malley holds some berries and part of the carrot. "This is ceremonial," he says, "sharing food and the singing. It must be part of whatever they think the weapon exchange means." I sniff the cookie again. The scent sends my hunger soaring. "Not eating might insult them," O'Malley says, "but we don't know if this stuff is poisonous." I sniff the cookie, smell a trace of that purple fruit. "Only one way to find out," I say. I pop the cookie into my mouth. Why not start with dessert? Sure enough, it is sweet, crumbly and chewy at the same time. There is a funny taste to it, but overall it's delicious. Maybe anything would be delicious after 2 days without eating. "Oh well," O'Malley says. "If they can't give us safe food, we're going to starve anyway." He takes a big bite of the carrot. He chews once, twice, then his eyes close in pleasure. "So good," he says. "Actual, real food." I bite into the meat. It's so spicy it burns my tongue a little, but I don't care. I eat it all. The springers eat too, big mouths, taking surprisingly dainty bites. They are giving O'Malley and me funny looks. Maybe the way we eat is disgusting to them. I glance at O'Malley. He's smiling, chewing with his mouth open. Some berry juice dribbles down his chin. Well, he's disgusting anyway. I think about Farrar's horrible experience. If this food does to me what that food did to him, it won't take long. I close my eyes, wait for the choking to begin. It doesn't. The only bad thing that happens is my stomach grumbles even louder. It worked. We can eat their food. If we can figure out where to get the purple fruit, how to use it, the whole reason for Aramovsky's war will vanish. O'Malley, can you draw? Of course I can. I point to the cloth I marked up with lines. Draw the purple fruit I brought back to the shuttle, quickly. O'Malley starts right in. His lines are soft, delicate, and perfect. The shape of the fruit is exactly right. He adds shading. It looks so real I could almost pick it up. Barca starts stamping his left foot. Hard to tell for sure, but I think he's delighted. I tap my fingertip on the drawing, look at the springer prints. "This," I say. "Where do we find this?" He gives me an odd look, and I'm pretty sure I understand what it means. He thinks I'm kidding. I thump the drawing hard. "Please, where do we find this? Show us." Barca glances at Lafa. Lafa hobbles to the double doors, motions for us to follow. Outside, the rain has stopped. Twin moons shine down,
lighting up the jungle with a spooky glow. Lafa hobbles to a tree, taps it. I look up, searching for the purple fruits. I don't see any.
Where are they? O'Malley asks.
Oh no, what if they aren't in season? Rikis and Totoback both make that broken glass noise. They are laughing at us. The two springers hop to the tree. Their hands grip a vine that clings tightly to the trunk. Together they pull once, twice. On the third yank, the vine rips away from the trunk, chunks of bark coming with it. Rikis pulls a knife, slices the vine at eye level. The severed end dangles there, held aloft by the rest of the vine that snakes through the branches above.
Maybe they thought we meant something else, O'Malley says.
Should I go get the drawing?
I would answer, but I'm holding my breath.
Rikis and Totoback grip the part of the vine that's growing up from the ground. Together they count. Kayat! Jeg! Nar! And they pull. The wet ground at the base of the vine breaks, lifts up a little.
It can't be, I say.
All this time it was that easy?
O'Malley looks at me.
I don't understand.
Kayat! Jeg! Nar!
And they pull again. The ground gives way. They stumble back, holding the vine. From the end dangles the purple fruit, thin strands of white fiber sticking off it, clods of dirt clinging to the purple surface and strands alike.
We were looking in the wrong place, O'Malley says, astonished.
It's not fruit at all. It's a root.
The root of the vines that cover city streets, jungle trees, buildings, ruins. The secret to our survival has been all around us all this time.
Vines are everywhere, O'Malley says.
Aramovsky is taking us to war for something that's everywhere we look.
War. I look at the night sky, off to the east. The first hints of glowing red, maybe an hour until dawn.
Barca, we need to leave, I say.
I reach out, tap his fist, the one holding the coin and the piece of glass.
We have to stop the battle.
He barks out orders.
Rikis fast hops into the building, comes out with the map and O'Malley's drawing of the fruit.
Rikis keeps the map. Barca takes the fruit drawing, rolls it up and carefully puts it in his bag. The Springer Prince pauses. He looks at the knife in his belt, traces the handle with his fingertips, admiring the weapon by both sight and touch. Then he barks more orders.
Rikis and Totoback plunge into the jungle, headed for the trail.
Barca follows, gesturing for us to walk with him.
Lafa unslings his musket and lumbers along behind, a hobbling rear guard.
Together, we're heading off to stop a war, and hopefully, not get killed in the process.
We move through the jungle. It's still dark, yet it's already getting hot. A thick mist glows with the light of two moons, blankets the endless overgrown ruins. Rikis and Totoback are out front, making sure the trail is safe. O'Malley and I stay with Barca. Lafa is in the rear, struggling to keep up. Our feet squish in thin mud. As we walk, I rub that mud on my face, tie new vines around me, smear juice in my hair and skin. If something goes wrong, I want to be able to fade away into the jungle.
O'Malley smiles at me.
We're going to save everyone, he says.
I can feel it.
The moonlight seems to settle in his blue eyes, makes them sparkle. In all that's happened over the past few days, I'd forgotten how beautiful he is. He's not a warrior, yet he faced grave danger to be at my side. In a way, that's even braver than anything Bishop has done.
O'Malley, Kevin, sees me looking at him. He makes an awkward smile, then shakes his head and faces down the path.
What? I say. What's so funny?
Nothing.
No, come on, tell me.
When he looks at me again, the smile is gone.
I told you I loved you, he says.
You didn't say how you feel about me.
I look down, watch my booted feet splashing along the trail.
Why didn't I tell him how I feel?
Because I didn't know for sure. I still don't. And besides, we have a war to stop.
This isn't the right time to discuss it, I tell him.
A little bit of the light drains from his eyes. He's still smiling, but but it's not quite as divine as before.
I guess it's never the right time, he says. After we stop this battle, what then? We have to gather food, learn to use the purple root, fix what machines we can, deal with Bello.
There's always something, Em.
A war isn't just a something. Can we focus on that for now?
O'Malley's hands fidget with the hatchet Barca gave him.
It's all right, he says.
I get it.
You want to be with Bishop?
Oh my gods, boys are exasperating.
That's not what I want.
He raises an eyebrow.
It's not? You could have fooled me.
He speeds up, pulling ahead of me to walk side by side with Rikis.
Hey there, O'Malley says with forced joviality. And how is my favorite non-human today?
Rikis laughs a broken glass laugh, clearly delighted to be spoken to by an alien.
O'Malley told me he loves me.
Bishop didn't. Is that because Bishop can't? Or because he doesn't?
Him?
Barca leans closer, blinking. I know instantly that the alien is asking if I'm okay. Our two races are drastically different, yet we can read each other somewhat, understand each other's intent. If we can do that, we can overcome any language barrier.
I'm fine, I say.
Thank you.
Barca points down the path.
Kevin?
Is Barca asking if O'Malley is all right, or if I'm upset because of him?
Either way, the only answer I have is to shrug. I doubt Barca knows what that gesture means, but if he's going to spend time with teenage humans, he'll figure it out soon enough.
When Matilda created me, why couldn't she have just programmed away these stupid emotions? Life is hard enough without having to worry about who likes who.
Maybe I should go talk to O'Malley.
When I said, that's not what I want, maybe what I meant was, I don't know what I want.
O'Malley has his faults, sure, but he's been behind me every step of the way, almost from the moment we woke up. He supports me, he believes in me, and unlike Bishop, O'Malley comes right out and says how he feels about me. Things have been so desperate, so crazy. Maybe I don't know what I want because I haven't had a moment to actually think about what I want. Now that I do, maybe I want the same thing O'Malley does. And that scares me.
I see him up ahead, walking with Rikis and Totobak. The hanging fog is a haze around them, blocking my view of anything farther down the path.
Rikis's long tail rises straight up, goes stiff.
Barca grabs me, stops me, even as Rikis does the same thing with O'Malley. It's just like when Visca or Bishop put a fist in the air, a noiseless symbol for everyone to freeze.
Far up ahead in the mist, I see two figures approaching. Humans.
I can't make them out.
O'Malley is farther ahead than I am. He must be able to see them better, because he calls out,
Coyote! Is that you?
Hey, O'Malley!
Coyote's voice. He's alive.
O'Malley lets out a whoop of joy. I start to make the same noise, but Barca squeezes my arm tighter, telling me to stay quiet.
Hey, O'Malley says, his excitement audible.
Is that Beckett with you?
From the fog, another voice answers.
It is.
Beckett? They're both alive? Maybe Mueller is as well. If I can take them to the battlefield with me, and with Barca, and with the secret of the purple root, Aromovsky's power will evaporate like so much jungle mist.
I want to run to them, but Barca won't let me go.
We didn't expect you, O'Malley, Beckett calls. You're not supposed to be here. Where's Em?
Why would Beckett say you're not supposed to be here? Have they already been back to the shuttle? But if they have, why would Aromovsky send Beckett back out looking for me? Beckett is a gear. He's not suited for stumbling through a hostile jungle in the middle of the night.
I have to be honest with you, O'Malley, Coyote says. I think your new friend is really, really ugly.
For an instant, the surrounding fog flashes like we're inside a cloud filled with lightning.
Totobak screams. His body is ripped apart, pieces of him scattering through the jungle.
38. Totobak's death cry echoes through the trees. The blazing light blinks out as fast as it flared up, leaving me seeing spots.
I think of El Safani.
Barca slams into me,
knocking me off the path to the right. We crash hard in the wet underbrush. I scramble to my feet, crouching, hands tight on the shovel. We're under attack. Totoback is dead. Coyote or Beckett must have killed him. Back at the shuttle, Borjigin was working on the spider cannon. Did he fix it? Is that cannon like the grown-ups' bracelets? The weapons that killed Elsa Fani? I can't see through this fog. O'Malley shouting for help, terrified. I stay low, in the cover of the underbrush, and move toward the trail's edge. Barca is on my right, doing the same thing, musket clutched in his odd hands. A burst of red light blinds me as a whoomp rattles my ears, knocks me flat to my back. The world spins. I hear a Springer screaming in agony. I roll to my hands and knees, ignore the pain as I slowly push myself up. My legs feel weak. I grab my shovel. I see Barca, his musket barrel leveled over a fallen log made fuzzy by blue moss that gleams with tiny spots of wetness. The hammer of his weapon is cocked back. He's trying to find a target through the fog. I run to him, kneel down. I look over the log, something fist-sized and black spinning through the air toward us. It hits the jungle floor, bounces once, then bursts with a whoomp and a flash of red light. An invisible punch slams me backward through the underbrush. I hit the ground hard, skid, roll into a thick bush. Every part of me hurts. My ears ring. The ground seems to lurch and buck beneath me, even though I'm lying flat. What is happening? Where's O'Malley? A groan. Barca, maybe 20 steps away, crumpled and unmoving, on his side at the base of a tree, his musket next to him. He's hurt. Together he and I can stop a war. I have to help him, protect him. Somehow, I held on to my shovel. I lean on it, fight to regain my balance as I struggle to stand. I hear footsteps. I drop down, let the underbrush cover me. Through the thick fog, someone is approaching, Barca. Black coveralls. Coyote? Beckett? Moonlight gleams blue and maroon off the person's arms and legs. No, those reflections are from a metallic frame worn on his body. A pitch-black, gnarled body. The bottom falls out of my world. Those aren't coveralls. I'm looking at a grown-up. It's big, not quite Bishop's size, and wears some kind of suit. A mask covers its face, clear bubbles of glass showing the red eyes beneath. Lines of reflective metal run down its thick arms and legs. On its right arm, just below the elbow, is a silver bracelet, white stone glowing softly, long point ending behind the wrist. A spider cannon didn't kill Totoback. A bracelet did. Just like the bracelets that killed Elsa Fani. In that horrid instant, everything becomes clear. That thing I couldn't place. That feeling that I had missed something. Bella wasn't the only one in the lumpy ship. Brewer said the grown-ups couldn't survive on Omeocan, couldn't breathe the planet's air. It never occurred to me that they could bring their own air with them. Overwritten Bella was nothing more than a decoy. We focused on her when the real threat had left the lumpy ship before we even arrived. When I sent Coyote, Beckett, and Mueller out, the grown-ups must have grabbed them. Someone joins the grown-up. It's Beckett, dressed in black coveralls, wearing a bracelet on his right arm. Beckett has been overwritten. Coyote, too. He must be. And if he's still alive, Mueller. Beckett and the grown-up cautiously move toward Barca. They don't see me. I am a camouflaged black blob crouching in the black shadows, hidden by leaves and vines. I could slink away into the jungle. If they catch me, I will be overwritten. Everything that I am will be erased. Barca moves weakly, one of his three eyes a wet, ruined wreck. The grown-up takes a step closer to him. That tingling feeling, spreading down my scalp. Rage detonates inside me like a crater-making bomb. Our creators. They bring death everywhere they go. Yes, I could run, but the time for running is over. I am the wind. My pain forgotten, I lean forward in a careful jog that grows to a silent sprint. Barca struggles to rise, looks up, sees the grown-up. Ugly bastards, the grown-up says, and points his bracelet right at Barca's face. I am death. My foot cracks a branch. The grown-up turns, sees me coming, swings the bracelet arm in my direction, but the wrinkled abomination is too old and too slow. I thrust the shovel forward, putting all my strength, weight, and speed behind the blow. The point punches into the black throat, through it. I feel metal on bone, the impact shuddering down the wooden handle, and then, no resistance at all. A head tumbles through the air, trailing a curving arc of red-gray blood. The mask flies away. The body, lifeless and limp, sags to the ground. The head lands, rolls, stops. Beckett stares at the severed head, his face contorted with horror. I start toward him, but stop instantly when his arm snaps up, bracelet point aimed at my chest. He's 5 steps away, too far. I'm as good as dead. Beckett lowers his arm slightly, seems confused. Why doesn't he shoot me? Matilda? Is that you under all that gunk? Red-gray drips from my shovel blade. I take 1 step closer. His arm snaps up again. I freeze. Ah, of course, you're M, he says. So strange. I haven't seen your face in 1,000 years. You look so young. But then again, I guess I look young too. It's him, and it's not. There's just enough moonlight for me to make out his red hair, his tan skin, the gear symbol on his forehead. This is the shell of a boy I knew, yet his familiar eyes burn with a hate far beyond the years of his body. Go away, I say. Leave us. Get in that ship and return to the Zolotl. No one else has to die. He shakes his head. I'm supposed to take you to her. But you know what? If her shell dies, then the old hag has no future. No one will listen to someone who is just going to wither and crumble. He grins. If I kill you, that creates a power vacuum, and nature abhors a vacuum. His bracelet's white stone glows brighter, a thunderous bang from right behind me. Beckett blinks, confused. Blood spurts from a neat hole in his throat, red and rich, not grayish and sickly. It sprays onto the jungle floor. He tries to say something, but no sound comes out. He takes a single weak step forward, then falls flat on his face. He doesn't move. Barka's musket is across his lap, smoke still curling from the barrel. He's trying to reload it, his every movement clearly an exercise in agony. I pull the bracelet off Beckett's limp arm, slide my own hand through the opening. When the ring is almost to my elbow, something contracts, squeezes. The bracelet clings firmly on my arm. Its lethal point is just behind my wrist. If only I knew how to make the damn thing fire. I kneel by Barka's side. Can you move? His middle eye is a mangled, horrible sight. The other 2 green eyes blink, look at me, show recognition. He tries to put the rod into the barrel, winces. I set my shovel down, take the musket and do it for him. He hands me a bullet. I pack that down as well, slide the rod into its holding slot, then hand the musket back. I hold my left hand in front of him, palm up. I point to him, then place my right pointer and middle finger on the upturned palm. I bounce them, doing my best impression of a springer's hop. Move, I say. Can you move? Move, he answers. He understands. Him, move. Shovel in one hand, I reach under Barka with the other and struggle to lift his weight. The alien makes sharp grunts of pain. The blast threw him hard into that tree, maybe broke things inside him. I have to get the prince to safety, but I also have to find O'Malley. From behind us, another flash of white lights up the fog. How many grown-ups are out here? The enemy seems to be everywhere. The jungle is made of them. We stay in the underbrush, move parallel to the path, dragging the heavy springer along with me. I am not the wind anymore. I am noise. I am a target. Then in front of us, a dead springer, stomach sliced open, splashes of blue blood and yellowish innards strewn about the wet vines and dead leaves. I recognize the curve of the mouth. Rikis. Barka lets out a mournful groan. The sound is heartbreaking. He points just past the body, at Rikis's musket. The hammer in the middle.
It's cocked back. It's loaded. Noise from behind us. Human shouts and calls. Bodies moving through the mist. I recognize one of the voices. Coyote. Barca gently pushes me away. He stands on his own two legs, points to me, points to Rikus's musket. I have the bracelet, but I don't know how to use it. I drop the shovel and I pick up the gun. Barca takes one experimental hop forward. His body shudders in pain, but he pushes past it, takes a second hop. Him. Move. He wants to run. He wants to hide. That's the smart thing to do. Just as I need him to end this war before it starts, he needs me to make it out of here alive. The two of us fleeing into the jungle is the smart thing. But I will not leave O'Malley. I wave a hand in the direction of the trail. Go, I say. Move, escape. His two remaining eyes show despair. He doesn't want to leave me, but he is in no shape to fight. A rustling to our right. Our muskets rise up instantly, aim at a shaking bush. Laffa hops out from behind the dark leaves. I point at him, then at Barca. Get him out of here, I say quietly to Laffa. Move. Maybe he understands me, or maybe he just wants to get his prince clear. Laffa pulls at Barca, urging him down the trail. I turn and run into the mist, toward the danger, toward O'Malley. My body feels electric, on edge. I hear voices. I slide to my right into the underbrush, crouch between two wide curving leaves that cover me completely. A small gap between them lets me see down the trail. Moonlit mist surrounds me. This is the perfect spot. The shadows are my friends.
She killed Beckett,
a grown-up man's voice. I hear him, but can't quite see him.
And Visca. She cut off Visca's damn head. I'm going to kill that little bitch.
Something about that voice is familiar, but I can't place it. Another voice answers, one I know by heart, one that makes every inch of me crawl with fear.
Farrar, don't you dare.
That voice, Matilda. She was on the lumpy ship with Bello. She's here. She's come for me, to erase me.
Hurt her and you die, she says.
Her voice is coming closer.
Or I'll make sure your shell dies. I'll watch you wither away to nothing. Find out if there are any more hopping vermin around here. Kill them, then catch her.
I hear footsteps squish in mud. Hear small branches crack and snap. They are coming closer. Even if they're old and slow, they're still faster than the wounded Barca and Laffa. If I let Matilda and Farrar pass by, they will quickly catch up to the Springers. Coming down the trail through the mist, I see a grown-up. A little shorter than I am, moving with painful, jerky motions. It is Matilda, and with her, taller, thicker, old and wrinkled but made of solid muscle. It has to be Farrar. They both wear masks and suits of thin, shiny metal, like the one I just killed, Visca. I killed grown-up Visca. Farrar comes first, a few steps ahead of Matilda. He wears a bracelet on his extended arm, sweeps it left, then right. Then straight down the trail. He doesn't see me. In seconds, he will pass by me. I can end this, all of it, right now. I can shoot him with the musket at close range, drop him, and then I must kill Matilda. The musket will be empty. I can use the wide flat end. I can swing it hard, smash it into her face, knock her down. Then I will cave in her skull. For Elsa Fani, for Beckett, for Coyote, for Mueller, for Latu. For Visca, for Harris, for Bello, for Yong. Matilda is my enemy. Kill her. And I will be forever free. She deserves to die. Deserves it for the thousands of humans she has murdered. For her slaughter of millions of Springers. For the culture she tried to destroy. For the ship she transformed into a nightmare. And for the enormous city she turned into cinders. Farrar and Matilda creep closer. I stay so very still. I am the wind. I am death. 5 steps away. My musket's hammer is already cocked. I silently raise the barrel, aim it to my left. I won't even have to extend it past the leaf. Farrar will move right past me. 3 steps. I put my finger on the trigger. 1 step. On my right, the big leaf rustles, splashes me with beaded rainwater as it is pushed aside. The red-eyed, masked face of a grown-up is only inches away. How could I have not heard it coming? It is the biggest grown-up I have ever seen, with wide shoulders and huge muscles stretching out the gnarled black skin. Then I realize how it snuck up on me. It's Bishop. A flash of black smashes into my face. As I fall, I see the two moons high above, one blue, one maroon, and then nothing. Part 5. Destiny and Doom. 39. I wake. My head pounds and throbs. Feels like it's full of jagged rocks, grinding against each other. I'm on my back. Lights above blind me. I blink madly. I try to raise a hand to block the lights, but I can't move.
She's coming too.
That voice, the hiss of a grown-up, a woman but so familiar. I almost recognize it.
Thank you,
says a second voice, one that is unmistakable and full of the promise of death. Matilda. She has me. Panic bites deep. I struggle to push it back, to stay in control. I can see a little now. The lights above are embedded in a carved ceiling. I'm indoors. I try to sit up, but something cool, solid, and curved pins my wrists, my waist, my ankles. White fabric to my left, to my right. I'm in a coffin. I yank and twist and lurch. I've broken bars like these before, and I'm much stronger than I was then. I pull until the coffin shakes with my effort, until my bones feel like they are going to break. Something is different. These bars. They're smooth, not rough against my skin. They aren't rusted. They're new. My arms give out in mid-pull, as if my muscles, bones, and skin realized escape is impossible before my brain does. I lie there, chest heaving, not knowing what comes next. A head leans in, silhouetted by the bright light. A grown-up, wrinkled, charcoal skin covered by a mask. Through that mask, I see one bulging red eye, and a white patch where the other eye used to be.
Hello, pretty girl, Matilda says.
I can't move. Death stares down at me. She turns, looks somewhere to her left. Lower the sides of the husk. I want to get a good look at her. A buzz. Then a soft clacking sound. All four sides of the coffin slide down and away. On my left, Matilda, and just past her, a closed golden coffin. It's been polished until the carvings gleam with a lifelike vibrance. On my right, a waist-high curved red metal wall with that strange symbol engraved on it in black. I'm in the observatory. Farther down on my right, two wrinkled grown-ups, wearing the same metal and mask array as Matilda, are standing on the pedestal platform. One is tall and thin. The other is the shortest I have seen yet. By height alone, I know it is the grown-up version of Gaston. I look past my bound feet, knowing what I will see. The big black X, shackles and crown dangling. Behind the X, the mural of an old man, a younger man driving a knife through his chest. Everything is clean. All the dust is gone. Where is O'Malley? Did he escape? I hope Barca and Lafa got away. Somewhere behind me, I hear a voice I know all too well.
You have what you wanted, Aromovsky says. Now give me what I need.
My body surges, thrums with sudden blind hope.
Aromovsky, kill her! Get me out of here!
I thrash at my restraints with newfound strength. He has to strike fast. How many circle stars did he bring with him?
Wait. What did he say?
Matilda continues to stare down at me. I hear footsteps. Then I see him. Aromovsky standing beside her, my spear in his hand. He is wearing red robes, just like those of the torturers, carved into the observatory walls. My body starts to shake. I struggle to breathe. Why is he standing with her? Why isn't he fighting her? Matilda reaches up a wrinkled old arm and rests her hand on Aromovsky's red-robed shoulder.
You're lucky, boy, she says.
You lured my shell away from the others, but she was almost killed by that disgusting vermin army.
I can't believe what I'm hearing. Bello didn't just give Aramovsky the secret of the symbols so he could take over as leader. She told him where to send me. He gave me up to Matilda.
We didn't know there were so many of them, he says. If you had grabbed her at the gate, like you were supposed to, she wouldn't have been at risk.
He tilts his head toward me.
Besides, she looks fine.
Matilda adjusts her mask, as if the fit bothers her.
She looks filthy.
But we did run late. Sometimes old bodies do not react as quickly as one would like. At any rate, a deal is a deal. She looks off to her left.
Bring them.
I hear heavy footsteps approaching. I crane my head up to see. It's Coyote, young and strong and smiling, carrying a large carved box. I feel heavier, like I'm sinking into this coffin, like I'm drowning in darkness. Coyote has been overwritten, same as Bello, same as Beckett. Coyote walks and talks and looks like my friend, the one who taught me how to sharpen the spear, but my friend is gone forever. He sets the box down on my thighs.
See, Matilda, he says. I told you she was in good shape.
A whining tone to his voice. He is desperate to please her.
But Matilda is far from pleased. Your body has far less damage, Uriah, she says to him. Look at her. She hasn't fixed anything. Some of these scars are never going to come out.
Coyote shrugs.
You might have to hose her down first. All that camouflage on her face. Somehow she fooled herself into thinking she's a knight.
A knight? Is that what the Circle Stars are really called?
The folly of youth, Matilda says.
Such beauty, yet she doesn't care.
I was like that once.
I won't make that same mistake again. I'll treasure my youth. This time, I'll savor every last moment of it.
Coyote reaches into the box, pulls something out, holds it up for Aramovsky to see.
It's a silver bracelet. The ceiling lights play off the white stone, gleam against the long metal point.
20 of them, Coyote says. Aramovsky slowly reaches out a trembling hand, takes the bracelet.
20, he says. With these in our war machines, we'll slaughter the Springers.
How do I use it?
Matilda pulls Aramovsky closer to her. I see his lip curl slightly, involuntarily.
Remember our deal, she says, her words syrupy sweet. When you attack, you will not use people on the list I gave you. Their creators are waiting. Those shells must not be risked.
He hasn't attacked yet. There's still time.
Aramovsky nods. I understand. And should I still send you Bishop Gaston and Borjigin?
Yes, she says. And make sure you do it before the battle. We need to take out the strongest first. A few at a time, so there are no more accidents.
Make sure they come alone, and through the entrance I showed you. We'll gas them there so they don't put up a struggle. These children are dangerous.
Matilda looks down at me.
You cut off Fiske's head with a shovel?
Really, my dear. That's so, well, so savage.
An insane cackle bubbles out from behind her mask. Aramovsky lifts the box off my thighs. He starts to turn away, then stops, turns back, leans close.
Don't be afraid, he says. The gods want this for you.
He means it. He believes every word. I spit in his face. He stands, shocked and angry, spit clinging to one closed eye. He wipes it away with the sleeve of his red robe.
You've always thought you were smarter than me, he says.
Not smarter, I say. Deadlier. Tell your gods I'll send you to meet them very soon.
Coyote guides Aramovsky away, somewhere behind me. They must be walking to the racks with the empty plastic bins.
Leave her be, Coyote says. I'll walk you out and show you how to use the bracelets.
My brave words ring hollow. The reality of my situation pushes down on me. I have failed in every way. Barca's people outnumber mine 100 to 1, maybe more, but those bracelets will even the odds.
Aramovsky is only going to use people that don't have a living grown-up ready to take over their body. Many of those that fight will die, sacrifices to the god of blood.
Those that do not fight will be rounded up a few at a time. Then their minds will be wiped, their young bodies used as a vessel for ancient evil.
Just as I will be used. Matilda delicately reaches for my face. I thrash my head away, lurch at my restraints. But there is no escape. When her hand comes close enough, I bite at it. She pauses, her fingertips just out of reach. Biting again. Matilda walks to the platform, grabs something there, brings it back. She's holding a thin red cane. She shows it to me.
Remember when Grandpa used one of these on us, when we cursed? You know what he always said. Spare the rod, spoil the child.
A flick of her wrist raises it. Another flick brings it down on my stomach. Agony engulfs me. My body can